tonight, while council are collecting their files and papers, we'll ask the council for the next case to come forward. That would be Matthew Washington versus the State of Nevada, case number 65998. Good morning, Ms. Dickinson.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Ms. Piper, how are you? Who do you have with you, Ms. Piper?
I have Ms. Skiffelaffa.
Hi, how are you? Welcome to all counsel.
Your Honor, I also have some people with me. Matthew Washington's family has come to court to hear the oral argument. His father, his mother, and his sister.
Okay, welcome. All right, Ms. Dickinson, you may proceed if you're ready. I know that it's a challenge to address all of the issues you presented in the brief in 15 minutes in oral argument, but for myself, I would appreciate if you would address two issues in particular which I think raise questions of first impression, and that is how the court should address what you've dubbed double jeopardy, which perhaps is more likely redundancy under the unit of prosecution issue, and then as well the question about whether or not the co-conspirator was properly pled. You can certainly argue, and counsel can address any other points you've raised, but those are two for which I wanted clarification and asked you to address during oral argument.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor. With the court's permission, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Yes, ma'am, of course.
May it please the court, my name is Sharon Dickinson and I represent Matthew Washington. Matthew is a 23-year-old boy who, as a result of this case, will not be eligible for parole until he's 80 years old. With regard to the first issue in the brief, which is the evaluation of the unit of prosecution or double jeopardy under NRS 202.285, the court must decide whether it's one crime or 10 crimes if a person discharges a firearm into a structure on the same day, the same time, same weapon.
That's actually two different weapons, but...
That is correct. There were two different weapons used. The state pled it only as firearms.
Okay.
They did not independently plead the weapons. So does a violation of NRS 202.285 involve a course in conduct analysis, or does it allow the state to convict a person for each bullet fragment, or cartridge they can identify that they find at the scene? In this case, Matthew was found guilty of 10 counts of discharging a firearm under three different theories. And looking at the NRS 202.285, which I have as a double jeopardy, states redundancy, but it is the unit of prosecution test. It's important to see that it's housed in Chapter 202, Crimes Against Public Health and Safety, and it's in the weapons section. NRS 202.285 makes it a crime when a person willfully and maliciously discharges a firearm at or into any apartment. In this case, it was alleged that the apartment was not abandoned. A plain meaning of the words of 202.285 makes the unit of prosecution the firearm, since it's in the weapons section, but more correctly, the use of the firearm at or into a structure. This court has used this unit of prosecution test in other cases, such in the Firestone case, The court found the use of the car and leaving the scene counted as one violation of that statute, even though there were a number of people injured. And in the Wilson case, the court determined that the prohibited act was the use of the child in the production. And thus, numerous pictures taken at the same time, which is a course of conduct, only counted as one crime. And then in Ebeling, the same, displaying one genitals, it was one act, one crime, regardless of how many people saw the act. Now, the Jackson court recognized these as unilateral prosecution cases, which were a little bit different than the Jackson case because there were two different statutes being evaluated. Here we only have one statute and one act. When looking at statute of construction, the court needs to look at the plain meaning of the words because that's what we presume the legislator intended. That's how we first look at their intent. Because they use the word discharges, I conclude that they mean a course of action, not just every time someone shoots a weapon. If they wanted it to be every time someone shoots a weapon or every bullet that's recovered, they would have said something. They didn't say that. So I believe the plain meaning of the words in that statute show it's a course in conduct, discharges. They didn't say discharge, they used the word S.
But you found that case that it's ambiguous at best to read it as the state contends, which is each shot is a discharge of the weapon, and that the rule of lenity should therefore cause us to construe it as covering a series of shots rather than just one. Is that fair?
Yeah, now that was...
That's a fallback. I get what you're saying. It's plain meaning first, and then fallback is at best it's ambiguous.
That's correct.
Or at worst for you, yeah.
Right. So that's how I interpret the statute, and that's how I would analyze it under the plain meaning.
You cite in your reply brief some cases from elsewhere around the country because we're not unique in having a statute that penalizes shooting in the buildings. And the cases you cite seem to be, well, obviously in your favor, there are other jurisdictions, but is there a split of authority on how you interpret these kinds of statutes? Is that what your research shows?
You know, I didn't evaluate a split of authority. I looked for the cases that concluded the same thing as I
was advocating. Yeah, fair enough. Okay.
You weren't doing a law review, Ms. Dickinson?
Pardon?
You weren't doing a law review? I'm teasing. Go ahead.
Well, I try.
You were advocating as Justice Pickering notes. No problem with that. That's what you're supposed to do.
Thank you. With regard to the second issue, with regard to the pleadings and the sufficiency of the evidence, I think it's important to point out that even though there was not an objection below, we need to raise this at this time under the Rational versus State case. Otherwise, it's waived if it goes to post-conviction. So that's why we're bringing it up. Our office did not handle the trial below. We were put on the appellate stage. And this particular attorney did not object to the pleadings, but I can say that on the appellate area, it's very difficult to even evaluate the insufficiency or sufficiency of the evidence based on these pleadings. They added a unknown co-conspirator in here, and the wording of the pleadings groups everybody doing everything together, or may have done one thing or another, and may have just been a lookout. And the problem with that is, under the aiding and abetting and other cases, IKEA, in particular, they have to specifically plead what the defendant allegedly did in order for him to have notice and to be found guilty, because the jury is using this.
Accepting that point is true, though, under the facts of this case and as the trial progressed, wasn't the focus just on, and I don't know if I pronounced this correctly, Martel Moten as the co-conspirator? There wasn't any suggestion in the facts of the case that there was this other unnamed conspirator or even an unnamed conspirator, correct?
In the presentation of the evidence, that is correct.
Even though the information might recite some unnamed co-conspirator, and maybe under the jurisprudence that would be inappropriate if it was standing alone, where there is a named co-conspirator in that circumstance and the trial focuses on that individual, then is there a problem with that?
Well, there is a problem because the jury instructions included information on the unknown conspirator.
Mm-hmm.
So the jury was given that theory.
Mm-hmm.
Although the state did not argue that theory very much in closing, they did mention it. And we know it was an important...
It's a problem, though, with the plain error standard. I'm struggling on some of the issues in this case that there was no objection made, and I appreciate that you weren't trial counsel. But what do we do when it seems to me if an objection had been made, it could have readily been corrected in the district court? So what do we do with that on appeal when there was no objection and no course correction? Because it could turn out that somebody strategically leaves correctable errors in the trial record in order to come forward as you are now saying, well, we get a do-over even though we didn't object. So you talk about plain error and it's always how did it prejudice the defendant, but doesn't plain also have to do with something so unmistakable that it really couldn't be waived?
I understand what you're saying about somebody trying to create error. I don't believe that occurred in this case. I know the attorney said on one point in the record that he was doing this pro bono, and so I don't think there was any...
Right, but I'm talking, we have to apply the law neutrally, so our standards on plain error, if there's no objection, what do we do?
Well, I think that you can see plain error in this case based on the jury question. The jury sent back a question saying, what do we do about the unknown conspirator? Are we supposed to assume that somebody else was there? And the court just said, look at the jury instructions. So we know that the jury was looking
at the court. Did the court consult with counsel before the court answered the question?
That part I don't remember. I'd have to look back at the record. But I did put that question in the record, and I was reading it just yesterday. So it does show the jury was using that as a theory. And the problem with that is once they decide some unknown person was there, they can convict him of anything by saying, well, he helped the unknown person by being a lookout of some sort.
Okay.
And
we do.
If I just add one thing, it's important to note that his DNA, his fingerprints, and all that were not found on the gun. So there was...
On either gun.
Yeah, there was nothing found. I
have one further question. I couldn't tell reading the record. Which gun produced the bullets that killed Walls? Does the record show that, whether it was the Glock?
Yes, it was the Glock.
Okay.
The Glock that was found in the dashboard that we argue was...
And that was the weapon that killed... the bullets killed... I know you don't want to admit that, but I mean...
Well, let me correct that. There was one bullet removed from him, and that was the Glock. Now, I don't recall if that was the bullet that the... doctor testified was when it was fatal, because there were actually...
Okay.
Wounds.
Yeah, that's what I was trying to figure out. Thank you.
Okay. Ms. Pike.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Danielle Piper. I'm here on behalf of the district attorney's office. In regard to the fatal shot, it was the .40 caliber that was found in the steering column where Matthew Washington was sitting. That was the fatal shot in regard to this case. Justice Hardesty, I'm going to assume that you asked the first two questions of counsel, so you want me to sort of cover those issues as well.
Thank you, yes.
In regard to the double jeopardy, in looking through this case and in looking through what the briefs were, my understanding is that double jeopardy usually applies when there are two statutes. In regard to this case, we're looking at a redundancy and a unit of prosecution issue in regard to this case. But I think the same can one statute cause multiple punishments is really what the court is looking at. One of the things that defense counsel, appellant cites is the Wilson case, where this court looked at a case where somebody took, I think it was Polaroid pictures, I think it was four pictures of a child in an uncompromising position, and the state in that case charged, I think, 4 counts. This court essentially said that that is one act, that the purpose of the Nevada child porn statutes are to protect children from harms of sexual exploitation and prevent distribution of pornography. In regard to this, and the other thing the court talked about in that case was Crowley, where the act of rubbing the outside of the pants of the child was a prelude to the acts that then followed, and the conduct was incidental to the sexual assault and constituted one episode. I think when the court looks at the statute, the unit of prosecution, the discrete act in this case is going to be the discharging of a firearm. What you are trying to prevent is somebody discharging a firearm into a building.
So if it's a fully automatic weapon and they shoot an entire magazine off, would that be one discharge or multiple discharges?
Multiple.
They one trigger pull.
Multiple discharges, because if, in my opinion, and I'm obviously...
But no, it's a statutory construction issue, so...
Correct. If you're going to treat an automatic weapon different from a weapon where somebody has to individually shoot, right? That's what you're asking me?
I am.
Okay.
How does the statute apply in your reading to a fully automatic weapon with one trigger pull will discharge around?
Each bullet carries a danger. Each bullet is what can shoot somebody and kill somebody. If you use an automatic weapon and you shoot it into an occupied building and 1,000 rounds can go off, 1,000 rounds can kill somebody. That is the conduct with which we are trying to prohibit. That is what we are trying to stop somebody from doing.
But the question is whether the legislature successfully covered that conduct in the language they used in the statute. So we're going full circle. Is the statute ambiguous? Is it plain by its language? It uses the word discharges, so that would suggest multiple discharges from the firearm as being one act. So, I mean, applying the usual rules of statutory construction, how does this court address, either in an order or an opinion, an interpretation of the statute that covers or embraces multiple shots fired from an automatic weapon?
I think in looking at the plain language of the statute, as well as the punishments that the statute prescribes, right? In this case, it's not just one punishment. You can do jail time or a fine and or both. I think that one discharge, or let's say 100 discharges from one firearm treated as one, I don't think that's what the plain language of the statute says.
How do you define discharge in this context then?
In the context of this case?
Yes, of this statute.
Each time Matthew Washington and Martell Moten fired into that home, now I realize that we've charged 10 and there were 13 shots fired. That is because at the time of the preliminary hearing, we did not have all of the crime scene analyst report. Matthew Washington...
But you're arguing outside the record.
Sorry.
Why? I'm focused on the language of the statute and what the word discharges a firearm that's penalized by that statute means according to its plain meaning.
Each time the firearm is discharged, that is a violation of the statute. Am I not understanding?
So the discharge to you is a bullet leaving a gun?
Correct, the muzzle of the gun. Each time that happens, that is a violation of the statute.
Now your opponent found law from other jurisdictions that suggests discharging a firearm into a building can cover a series of shots from one gun and be a single crime. I didn't see any cases from you from other jurisdictions on the other side of that question. Does such case law exist?
I do not know. I will be honest with this court. I do not know. I don't know if there's a split of authority in regard... Well, obviously there's a split of authority, but I don't know what is majority and what is the minority.
Well, it's not obvious there's a split of authority. Where's the case that opposes hers?
Well, there's Nevada, which so far we're one way, and then she has seemed to find other cases.
But we don't have a case that decides this. Do we?
I guess not.
I mean, so this could be it.
It could.
Okay.
In regard to...
When we're talking about rules of statutory construction and a statute is ambiguous, oftentimes in the analysis of statutory construction, before we get to the rule of lenity, the rule of lenity is generally considered when there's no other statutory construction that can be considered. The next rule that would be considered is, what did the legislature intend? Did you find anything in the legislative history of this statute which suggested that it was the intent of the legislature in using the language that it used to focus on multiple rounds leaving a weapon, an automatic weapon?
I did not.
So would you agree with counsel that we must look at the rule of lenity if the statute is viewed as ambiguous?
Yes.
And if we do, what's the result? What would be the analysis that the court would use in order to uphold the state's position applying a rule of lenity?
I don't know.
Okay. What's your view of the unnamed co-conspirator? I'm a little bit confused about while it was in there, although I can understand that at the commencement of the case when the information's filed, one would include that. But as the trial progresses, you weren't focused on some unnamed person. You seem to be focused on Moten, if that's the correct pronunciation.
At the preliminary here, when we received the statements of both Martel Moten and Matthew Washington, both of them essentially pointed the finger at each other and then said that there was another person, LG and or I think his name was LJ, had actually committed the crime. Both of them said essentially the same thing. I was in the car, the other person got out with LG and or LJ and committed the crime.
When there was some evidence that there was somebody in the back seat and possibly that LJ was in the passenger seat?
Matthew Washington was driving the vehicle. Directly sitting behind him was Martel Moten. The front seat, the front passenger seat was empty, and then, of course, the gun was, the 9mm was found behind the front seat.
Okay.
Next to, I guess, Martel Moten, for lack of a better term. At the preliminary, when we got their statements, essentially they were pointing the finger at each other. When we get to preliminary hearing, we present those statements to the justice court judge. At the time that we were going to go to trial, essentially motions for severance had been filed and were denied. Matthew Washington did not want to continue the case at all. In fact, he asked that a motion to suppress not be filed. Martel Moten asked for a continuance. Judge Gonzalez essentially did a de facto severance and sent Matthew Washington to trial. At trial, we were not sure if Matthew Washington was going to take the stand and essentially say, I didn't commit this crime, Martel Moten committed this crime with LG and or LJ. So essentially the strategy that we thought of was, we're going to plead it and see essentially, does he get up and say that? Does he not? Are they going to point to a third person? In regard to this case, we weren't sure what the defense was going to be, besides I did not commit the crime. But we weren't sure if it was going to be the co-defendant committed the crime with somebody else, or a third or fourth person had come in and committed the crime, because at the time of trial we were hearing different theories, but we did not know of a different theory. And so that is essentially why we pled it in that way, in the event that Matthew Washington, obviously he can't compel Martel Moten to come in, but if Matthew Washington got on the stand and said, I never did this, I was merely present at the crime scene, somebody else, I was sitting in the car at the time it happened, these two got out of the car and essentially did the shooting. That is sort of what we were strategizing at the time, and we didn't know even up until the end if he was going to do that or not, which is why we pled it that way.
Could you talk to me about the Confrontation Clause issue?
Sure. In regard to Anya Lester,
the ballistics testimony?
Essentially, when we went to trial, we typically ask if somebody reviews any of the work that the Las Vegas Metropolitan Crime Lab does. That's essentially what that testimony was. She didn't say, yes, this is what they said. They came in and said, I did great work. It's just to sort of do that double-check process and sort of inform the jury that it's not just, you know, she just doesn't do work and nobody's watching what she do, that there's a sort of check and balance system. And I think the other thing she testified to is that I think it's ASCLAD is the name of the lab that they sort of need to, or that they get accredited by, and that's one of ASCLAD's requirements.
Was there any objection on confrontation clause or other grounds to the testimony of this witness on those points?
No. Counsel did not object to that and object to other things that were brought up by appellant counsel.
Any other questions by the justices? All right. Do you have any other matters you want to cover, Ms. Piper?
No.
All right. Thank you. Ms. Dickinson, you have 4 minutes.
With regard to the plain meaning of the language of the statute, I want to point out that since the Firestone case, that statute has changed and it specifically allows for more than one conviction, depending on the victims in some cases.
Is that a 2015 amendment?
That's what I pulled up yesterday, unless I misread it, but I want to point that out because in this case, they did not specifically say each shot was one count. So the legislature has the ability to put this in there, and they chose not to. And discharges, to me, means a course of conduct. With regard to plain air, getting back to the question, I realize that it's always the defendant's responsibility to bring up everything to object, and everybody else seems to be able to do whatever they want. I suggest to you the pleadings are definitely the district attorney's responsibility. They're the one who finalized the pleadings, put the words in there, and they need to be held responsible if the pleadings are incorrect.
Is the analysis with respect to the unnamed co-conspirator, different as to count one than it is as to count 2 through 17?
I'm trying to remember the wording of count one. I know the other counts all individually said and co-conspirator and went into some facts. I'd have to look back at the count one to see exactly what the wording was. But I did believe that it's the same, except that in the count one, you did not have as many facts. It doesn't really say when the conspiracy occurred. But I noticed in the state's arguments at trial, everything was after the fact, where they were together after the fact. Well, how do you distinguish mere presence at that point then? Was he merely present after the fact or realized that was his girlfriend's car? But like I said,
well, in count one, the allegation is that defendant Matthew Washington and Martel Moten, along with an unnamed co-conspirator, did then and there meet. And in count two, it alleges by directly committing said act and or by defendant Matthew Washington and Martel Moten and or unnamed co-conspirator aiding or abetting each other and or defendant Matthew Washington and Martel Moten and an unnamed co-conspirator conspiring with each other. So there is a difference, it seems to be. Maybe it was unintended, but there appears to be a difference in the language in the charging of the count 1 and counts 2 through 17.
2 through 17 have all the additional theories of aiding and abetting, and there was, I think, vicarious liability in 1.
Which in those counts, it wouldn't be necessary to demonstrate or prove the existence of the co-conspirator.
In the other counts, except that they're all pled and are disjunctive, and we know the jury was confused and sent a question back asking us to assume that there is a third person here. And like I said, there's really no other evidence tying him to this crime. There's no eyewitnesses.
There's no motive. These people didn't know each other. The apartment, the curtains were closed, so nobody would know if somebody was there or not there, if it was vacant. There was no DNA. There was nothing that tied him to that scene, except he was in the car and he was driving the car. I realized the gun was eventually located near him in this panel, but his fingerprints weren't on it. So the state was unable to prove he directly participated in this in any way.
Okay, any questions from the justices? All right, thank you, Ms. Dickinson. Ms. Piper, we appreciate your arguments and your briefing, and the case will stand submitted. Thank you very much. We'll be in recess till 11:30.